Introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Sheila Solon, and I am the state representative for District 31, which is Blue Springs, Lake Tepawingo, and actually unincorporated Lee Summit.
We are so glad that you're here.
Happy to be here.
Let's play the open.
This is Statehouse Blend. I'm Sam Zeff.
And I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee
and donuts
to better understand the legislatures on both sides of the state line,
the issues and the people in Topeka
and Jeff City. Here we go. And welcome to the production studio here at KCUR 89.3. Glad to be here with Representative Sheila Solon, as well as with Eric Bunch, our citizen guest, who is policy director for Bike Walk KC. Welcome to you, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Glad that you both are here. So, Sheila, it's really good to meet you, and I feel bad that we haven't had you on this show sooner.
Hey, I love this show, so I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, I'm really glad you're here. And I guess I want to start, as we always do, by having you tell us about your family and any pets you have.
Oh, we have pets. But actually, I've been happily married for the past 31 years. I have two children. I have a daughter, Lindsay, who teaches first grade at James Walker in Blue Springs. She's a great first grade teacher. And then I have a son. He's 26, and he actually went to UMKC, and he's with IBEW. Great kids, and I was a real active mom. I was a PTA president and moms and tots and all that good stuff. And we do have actually two pets. My daughter has a little dog, Charlotte. That's a Morkie. And we have...
Your daughter has this dog. So is your grand dog?
Well, yes. Oh, okay. And we all seem right to have her over quite a bit. And then we have our Pomeranian, Sophie, that we love. That is such a sweet dog. So
I can imagine. Well, that's great. Well, thanks for giving us that glimpse of life around the Solon household. So tell us about the district that you've been representing for the past 6 years. I know it includes Blue Springs. What goes on in your district?
I'll tell you what, our district is, as far as Republican, Democrat, it's 50-50. About 25% of the households are labor. It's, your typical middle class area and diverse issues. But I'd say probably the most important things to folks in my district are, jobs, the economy, education, our roads, the things that you would expect. And not only was I in the legislature for 6 years, but I had been on the city council and on the planning commission. So 12 years in local government before I ever ran. My youngest, my son Spencer, went off to college and Republicans recruited me and really have enjoyed being in the legislature. But I've had a long time in the community.
So I guess I want to start with something that might seem like the most uncomfortable place to start, which is the fact that in the primary elections earlier this month, you were defeated by a fellow Republican. And so you won't be returning to Jeff City in January. You've had a really solidly conservative record. You're strongly supportive of the Second Amendment, conservative on a number of issues, and yet you attracted this Republican challenger, and he ended up winning. What happened?
Well, I had a successful time in the legislature, did a great job and have done a great job for my constituents, and I treated it as a full-time job. I went to every event, every Eagle Scout, took good care of my constituents, but last session we were threatened by a billionaire, David Humphreys, that as Republicans, if we voted against what our constituents wanted, and my constituents got a hold of me and really through my citizen surveys, emails, phone calls, overwhelmingly opposed right to work. And I really represented my constituents, but we were told if we voted against it, there would be millions dropped against us to take us out. And they dropped over a year, $500,000.
Can you talk about how that message was conveyed to you specifically?
You actually
sent emails.
We had emails and we had people visiting us and threatening us. And it was bullying at its worst. And when it all came down before the end of session, there was tweets and talk from the various people that they had gotten together and had a strategy. And they had coordinated efforts with Americans for Prosperity, which is the Koch brothers, Club for Growth, which is Rex Singfield's organization, and then the Humphreys people. And so they did radio, TV, mailers, emails, Facebook, social media, dropped a ton of money against me, and not sorry. It's what we're elected to do, represent our constituents. It's not my job to do what a billion, in this case, a couple of billionaires wanted. So I'm proud of my record. I'm proud of my success for this past 6 years, and no regrets. No regrets.
You're not the only Republican who met this fate in the primaries. Representative Nick King, another local representative from Liberty, also defeated in his primary. Also, his opponent funded by David Humphreys. I'm curious how well you felt supported by the Republican leadership.
Not at all. Not at all. There was no support. No support. The House Republican Campaign Committee, which I have been very supportive of in many ways, including financial ways, did not call me, support me, or help me. Leadership did nothing to help me. So, no, we were pretty much thrown under the bus, in all honesty. And, you know, we were told by the various groups representing these billionaires that Right to Work was very much wanted in my district. And I do think that I have constituents who wanted it, along with, you know, a lot of folks that were working families that did not want it. And if it was so important, it was not used in any of the campaigns against me. The campaigns against me were that I was against family values, that I took $81,000 in lobbyist gifts, which I don't. I pay everything back. It's zero. So it was based on lies and misinformation. And if Right to Work was such a big issue in my district, they certainly didn't use it. And when I was out knocking on doors, it came up, but it wasn't a deal breaker. People told me that they wanted it. Most times they didn't. And I did, to the best of my ability, gauge what my district wanted. And I had over 2,400 emails and phone calls against it to 86-4 when we did our polling, and when it came up and Americans for Prosperity was telling people through commercials to get a hold of me. And they did. But they got a hold of me to tell me to vote no. So I gauged what my district wanted to the best of my abilities.
And you mentioned the money that was given to opponents, to your opponent specifically. How much money did you spend in the campaign?
I spent $100,000, which is a lot of
that
money
is a lot
in a state
for
rep.
For
yeah,
a state
absolutely. But if you look at it, I was outspent 5-1. And I did commercials, I did radio, I had mailers. It was all positive, by the way. I didn't go down the negative road. And it's just hard. You know, you've got kids, and they tell you for every negative, you have to give 5 positives. And in my case, you know, for every commercial that I aired, there were 8 negatives. You know, for every mailer, I had 8 or 9 again that were very negative and nasty. And I think that right now, it's a weird election year. I think with what's going on in the presidential races, which is very negative, especially the Republican primary we just got out of, the gubernatorial race was just so nasty, along with the other statewides. I believe it suppressed the vote. There was very low turnout in my district, and I'm turned off by all the negativity. I think women are very much turned off against it, and I just think that most people stayed home. I think they were kind of turned off, and my race was just extremely negative and nasty, along with a lot of the other races where the Republicans were defeated in primaries.
Eric, you're our citizen on our show today. I know you're not in Sheila's district, but what do you think as you hear her tell her impressions of what happened in her own race?
Well, I just wanted to say thank you for standing up for what you believe in. I think that, you know, I've seen a lot of your record, and we don't agree on everything, but there are things that I think it's really unfortunate that you're not going to be in that in Jefferson City anymore representing your district, because I think that, you know, basically, knowing that, you know, if you didn't support Right to Work, knowing that was going to put your race in jeopardy, and still standing up against it, I think that's very, very admirable. And so I thank you for sort of being that voice of reason in Jefferson City for while you've been there. And though I don't live in your district, you know, it's very good. It was nice to have that sort of moderate voice of reason in Jefferson City when everything seems to be so divisive. So I guess I just wanted to say thank you. I think it's unfortunate that you were targeted in the way that you were. But also, you know, your support of sponsoring a bill, House Bill 1679, I believe it was, to expand birth control for women. I think that's something that really resonates with me. And so things like that are
why does that resonate with you, Eric?
Well, I'm a parent, and I realize how extremely difficult it is to raise children, and that's in a household where we have two parents, two loving parents, and knowing how much pressure that puts on a new mother. Providing access to birth control is something that I think is extremely important. It's vital for the health of our communities and for the health of our women. And so thank you for doing things like that, for those types of efforts. I think that's really fantastic. And it's unfortunate that you're not going to be that voice there anymore. But also, you know, you stood up against the religious liberty bill, for a variety of reasons, but I think that was providing another voice of reason. So I just wanted to kind of bring those things up and just say thanks for being that person there.
Can I ask, Sheila, I mean, Eric has named a couple of issues where you might have parted ways with some of your Republican opponents, although you actually got the birth control bill passed in the House. Did you ever feel like, when you were doing those things, gosh, I am butting heads with powerful people. This might cost me my place in this legislature.
You know, I never looked at it that way. I read the bills and I did what I thought was right. And, you know, if you're worrying so much about getting reelected, then you're not going to be doing a good job. Those were bills. And I do think that Republican women and, you know, women like myself who've raised children, we have a different kind of voice down there. And, you know, the bills that I sponsored were not the normal ones. My third year down there, I finally got past oral chemo parity, which capped out of pocket for those life-saving oral drugs at $75 a month once you met your deductible. It took me 3 years. Last year, I passed a bill, and then I got as an amendment regarding sexual assault on campuses. It was not easy to get passed, but I did, and it basically requires a memorandum of understanding between universities and law enforcement and how they handle sexual assault on our campuses. I read that big, it was like a 600-page report that Claire McCaskill had put out. But basically, 75% of our universities have no policies in place regarding protocols and jurisdiction regarding sexual assault. And probably the one statistic I could tell you a lot, but one of them that really concerned me was that 43% of our universities have not done a single investigation of sexual assault on their campuses for 5 years. So passed a bill that requires a memorandum of understanding between law enforcement and universities. Got that passed. So I think women, especially Republican women, we do have a voice and a strong voice on issues that maybe the men down there aren't really thinking about. And
have you ever felt like that voice has been compromised?
I wouldn't say it's been compromised. I would say it's more difficult. The birth control bill is a great example. I read that Oregon and California had passed legislation where pharmacists could prescribe birth control pills instead of having to go to the doctor every year. It's tough for women to take off from work, child care, and a lot of, you know, lower-income women don't have doctors. If we could do that, you have to go to the doctor within 3 years, and five other states have been looking at it. In fact, I think Tennessee passed it this year. And not only would it give greater access to women have birth control pills and hopefully reduce unplanned pregnancies, I'm pro-life. And so, you know, a lot of the bills we have are putting greater restrictions on it. If you're pro-life, I think the biggest thing would be to reduce unplanned pregnancies to begin with. And so I read this. I got excited. I talked to the Speaker of the House about it. In the interim, he was enthusiastic and gave me told me how to get it passed. And basically, if I could get the pro-life groups not to oppose it, that we'd get it through. And we did. And I exceeded what was asked of me. I didn't have, actually, when it passed out of the two committees in the House, I got the insurance companies to not oppose it. All the pro-life groups did not oppose it. And I actually had the gynecologists and the pharmacists supporting it. It passed out of both committees unanimously, passed out of the House with 97 votes. Even I didn't think that could happen the first year. But the interesting side note is it took me a whole month to get it from the calendar to a vote. And I kept asking the floor leader, can we bring it up? Can we bring it up? And finally, someone from his staff said, we'll bring it up if you ask him nicely.
ask him nicely.
Yes.
What does that even mean?
Well, I didn't know. So I told him he was super handsome and that could you please bring my bill up? And we did. And I thought to myself, if that's all it took, I would have done that a month ago. that's easy. So it's a different reality for women down there than it is for men.
Would you have been asked to do that if you were a male state representative?
I had the same question.
I don't think so. And I think maturity brings where I think probably in my younger days, I probably would have gotten upset. I want to get my bills passed. So, okay, I'll ask nicely and get it passed. That's probably the one thing among others, that regret not going back. I really wanted to work on that bill and get it passed out in the Senate. Mm-hmm. I think the fiscal note, if we could reduce unplanned pregnancies, 45% of the births in our state are on Medicaid. So if you could reduce by 10 to 20% unplanned pregnancies, and different studies have different statistics, but they say over 50% of pregnancies are unplanned, and give greater access to birth control, if you just take into account the prenatal, the cost of delivery, and the first year of the child's life, the fiscal note was $95 million a year savings to the state of Missouri. And we had been challenged by our speaker to try to bring down costs on our really expanding Medicaid and how we could do creative ways. And I thought this was a great bill, but I just to give you an example of probably getting things passed as a woman down there in some ways is harder, but you just have to not lose hope and just keep pushing forward, and you can get your stuff passed. So it has unique challenges.
As long as you ask nicely.
As long as you ask nicely, you can get things passed.
I that's a surprising story to me, I have to say.
It surprised me too. But like I said, if that's what it took, I could have done it sooner.
I guess I'm curious too. You mentioned already the spending differential in your primary campaign. Do you think we have a problem with money in Missouri politics?
I'm concerned, and probably losing my election, they do the polling, and I don't know how much you can believe, but I had like 80% name ID, 55% favorables, which is a lot for a state rep. I really went to all events, and I did a great job, and that makes me sad that I lost, because along with Ann Zare, who's out of St. Charles, they dropped almost $1 million to make sure that she did not win that Senate seat. It seems like it's going to strike fear in the hearts, unfortunately, I think, of legislators, that not only should you bow to the will of these billionaires, if you don't, they're going to take you out. So it's no longer representing your constituents and the folks back home, or even your party and what your party wants. It's going to be about what a couple of billionaires want. And we saw it in the gubernatorial race and the statewides. There was almost like a war between Rex Singfield and Humphreys of who can give the most money to which candidate to win the election. And
so, for example, in the Republican Attorney General primary, you had the two candidates facing off with all of this money from exactly those two individuals, and Humphreys' candidate won.
That's right, and we had it also in the governor's race where Eric Greitens won, and I think that people were just going for throughout the incumbents, and we want people without experience, you know, whether it's Trump or Greitens. So I do think we need to do something about caps on contributions that hopefully will be addressed. And my concern is at this point in time, you have people that want to run statewide courting the favor of billionaires, you know, so they can get $1 million check. And you folks like me, we make $35,000 a year. You're going to be threatened with your job if you don't do what a billionaire wants you to do. You should represent the folks who elected you. You should have you represent the people back home, and you have to look at that legislation of whether it's going to help working families. Is it going to help the average citizen? And you need to be the voice for the folks who don't have a voice, who don't have a lobbyist. But what you can do, such as reducing unemployment benefits, a lot of cuts that we make, citizens aren't down there advocating. But you got to look at those bills and say, is this going to help people or is it going to hurt people? And lobbyists have their place, but we're supposed to also try and be a voice for the folks who aren't down there, you know, bending all the legislators' ears.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the election year that we are in the midst of. I believe I heard you call it a weird year.
It is a very weird year.
Do you think it's as weird on the Democratic side and the Republican side? It's just weird overall?
I think it's weird overall, but I will say that there seems to be very much an anti-incumbent feeling. There seems to be, and of course, I'm a person that thinks experience counts. I was in local government for 12 years before I ever ran for the state House, and running statewide would need a lot more experience. So it seems like experience now is frowned upon. We want people with no experience. We have a person running for governor who has never held public office at all, which is interesting.
That's your party's candidate for governor.
That's our party's candidate.
Are you not supporting
Eric Greitens? I'm supporting the Republicans. But we had it definitely surprised me, and we had a lot of people on the ticket with more experience.
But you'll vote for Eric Greitens.
I will vote for Eric Greitens. He's a Republican, and I agree with him on the issues. He's our candidate. But I do think it's a year that there's very low turnout. I think the negativity and the name calling is different. I think we've taken it to really a low level as far as you just want to destroy your opponent, and it doesn't have to be true. And I don't like that. I want people to be able to campaign on what they're going to do or what they've done, and have us vote as informed voters on your record.
So what do you think will be the long-term impact on Missouri, on our politics, on our policies, as a result of a campaign that that includes candidates like Eric Greitens, and for that matter, as you mentioned earlier, Donald Trump? Does that change the not only the outcome of the elections, but the way debates will happen in the future in Missouri?
I think so, because I think that negative obviously works, and I think it's going to continue. I think there has been a trend with Jeff Rowe. You know, people would hire Jeff Rowe because a lot of times they just didn't want him going after them, so they hired him. So I think there has been a trend for a while now on negative politics, and at least on the Republican side, all of the strategists and people who run campaigns are men. And you see that. Women are turned off by this negative message, and studies have proven that. And if you look at the campaigns, they're run by men. They appeal to men. They're not run by women. And we always say, at least as Republicans, that we really want women voting and voting Republican. But our messaging, I believe, is really geared towards men and what's appealing to them.
How would you do it differently?
Positive. I have a positive campaign. I think that more issues that are important to women, such as child care, education, health care, and especially jobs. Women are concerned with everyday life, and men too, but the kitchen table issues, and you don't hear that talked about really at the national or at the state level, and that's what's important, I think, to men and to women. But we seem to be talking about issues that are more dramatic and get people's attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I it's interesting that you bring that up. I haven't seen a lot of campaign commercials this year because I've been trying to avoid. I watch Netflix all the time rather than the network television.
Is that for your own mental health?
That's for my own mental health. But I have caught a handful of Eric Greitens campaign commercials, and I've caught a few of Chris Koster's. And I noticed that there seems to be a pretty distinct difference, at least in the ones that I've seen. So it may be a small sample size, but Chris Koster seems to be more positive, more about his accomplishments, and more about sort of the getting down to details, versus Eric Greitens. It seemed to be a lot more negative. So I don't know if that's true, or if my sample size is bad, or if my anecdotes are bad. But do you notice that the Republican race is a little bit more negative, or the Republican side is more negative in this particular gubernatorial race?
I think you're probably going to see changes in strategy as it gets down. But this is an interesting race because, you know, Chris Koster used to be a Republican, and now
right.
he's a Democrat. And Greitens used to be a Democrat, and now he's a Republican. So it's an interesting race. It's an interesting dynamic. It's still early. But yes, I would say probably at this point, that's the way it seems to be going. But I think
sure
you'll see
it'll change
as they poll and figure out what's working and not working.
Sure.
And in my election, they had me 20 points ahead the whole election. So I've never believed in polling, and I certainly don't now. But I know, isn't it kind of interesting? But
very hard to poll small legislative districts.
It really is. It really is. And, you know, I continue to work hard, and I have always put my life in God's hands and, you know, tried to just kind of, I've never been a person who planned on being in politics. I never thought I'd be a state rep. And if we do put our life in God's hands, then we trust whatever the plan is for our lives. So, you know, everyone who helped me with the campaign felt really bad. And I'm like, hey, we did everything we could. We all worked really hard. It's just not meant to be. And you really have to accept that and go, you know, I'm meant to do something else right now, and I'm good. I guess probably the only part that I'm not good with is the power of money in races. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to have a chilling effect possibly on how people vote in the future. And that does concern me. But for me personally, you know, I'm in a good place.
I do want to ask you about one part of your job you are not quite finished yet with. You'll have to head back to Jeff City September 14th for the veto override session. Lots of bills have been signed. Lots have been vetoed. You'll have a lot of votes to cast there on whether to override any of Governor Nixon's vetoes. One of those that he did veto was one that allows the carrying of concealed weapons without a permit and expanding the self-defense provisions, the so-called Stand Your Ground law. That bill passed with enough votes to override the governor's veto. Yours was one of those. You've been a big supporter of gun rights. Will you vote to override the veto?
You know, we've had a lot of discussions. I think that when bills especially get loaded up on the Senate side or on the House side, hey, and I was guilty of it. I was a chairman of a committee, and I will say I did have a lot of scruples as far as what I allowed to get put on bills. They had to be amendments that had passed clearly, overwhelmingly in the House already and had been vetted through two committees. But I did load up a lot of Senate bills with our priorities. Sometimes it's the only way you can get bills passed.
Especially at the end of a session like this one.
Yeah, and it got loaded up with some things on it. I would say, in theory, I agree with what's in there. It's always the devil's in the details. And there's going to be a lot of discussion on these bills before we ever vote on them. And I believe that there will be due diligence to make sure there's nothing in there that would be harmful.
It seems fairly clear that they will bring up the Stand Your Ground and the permitless concealed carry bill. At this point, you see yourself supporting that again?
You know, I'll have to look. I know that a lot of the fraternity order of police is coming out against it.
Right.
And initially they were not. It's kind of surprising, but the police actually have more concerns with conceal and carry than open carry, which is sort of surprising because at least they know they have a gun. So that's probably more of their concern. So we'll have to look at the details and kind of
philosophically. So you're not sure yet how you'll vote?
Well, you know, philosophically, I agreed with the bill. I didn't have a problem with anything that it was trying to achieve. But, you know, words matter. And when we read these bills, we have to try to it's important to make sure that it's worded properly, because if it's not, it could have ramifications that were not conceived when it was drafted. And so that's something that I'm going to have to really look at closely.
Let's go around the table one more time to Eric Bunch, our citizen guest today.
Well, I'm just thinking about the permitless concealed and carry, I'm not a supporter of that. But the thing that comes to mind is that, you know, guns kill around 30,000 people a year in the United States, and that's about the same as automobiles. You know, car crashes kill about 30,000 to 40,000 people a year, and we require drivers to have a license, and that still seems to not be enough to protect people from traffic violence, as I like to call it. But I feel like the same sensible requirements should be in place for gun owners as well. So I realize that that's probably pushing back on you a little bit there.
That's
but,
okay.
That's an area where I think we certainly disagree. But I guess I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. You know, guns are dangerous, and I come from a rural community where lots of people have guns, and I don't have a problem with them in theory. But I do think that there should be some sort of, responsible ownership and some sort of. You know, a requirement for people to be trained with using them.
And I agree with you on that. Actually, my husband and I went through the Citizens Police Academy and went through a full training before I got my conceal and carry. Yeah. And it's important. And I have heard, and that's where I went, it's in the details. I've heard different sides on what's in that bill. I've been told that it's not permitless. It's that when you have already had it, when it's been permitted so many times, that then you would not have to. But initially and proceeding, you would have to have had some kind of training. So that's where the detail is on that one. Because I agree with you, there should be training, and it shouldn't be that you could get it without it. It's more of if you've had it several times, how many times do you have to have it renewed? That was
and whether you have to register locally with the local sheriff, so they know who has guns in their county and that sort of thing.
So it's not absolutely with no training. So that's where the details are. But I agree with you. I mean, we had an amendment on the floor that allowed guns on college campuses. And I did not support that. And I actually had interns in my office who argued with me because they were, you know, college students and they wanted to be able to carry. And I had concerns about guns on campuses because, you know, I think that we have young people, you know, and emotions raising high, and we actually have a high rate of depression, you know, for college students. So I did have concerns over that. And I will say the Republican women are the one who kind of led the charge saying, we really don't support this. So we can be pro-Second Amendment, but you're correct. We need to use common sense and make sure that we don't go too far the other way. But I'm a strong defender of our Second Amendment rights. And I believe that we have the right to protect our families and to make sure that we're safe. And the bad guys are always going to get guns. I mean, all the laws and rules in the world are not going to prevent the bad guys from getting the guns.
But those guns all started off as legal guns at one point. And so what was your thought about that? That at some point those guns were legally purchased, most likely, and then somehow they got in the hands of the bad guys. Does putting more gun restriction in place help prevent that flow of guns from good guys to bad guys?
Well, I'll say a lot of, you know, that's probably as far as when you have home burglaries and everything, that is what is stolen in most cases. But I guess the people that I know that have guns are responsible gun owners, and they have a lot of respect for it, you know. And I'll tell you what, if you have children in the home, I do not think you should have guns in the home, you know, especially loaded. They should be in the safe. And, you know, because
thank you for that.
As, you know, really,
I appreciate that.
I would never have had a gun in the house with my kids. I'm too fearful of it.
I'm not worried about those responsible ones. I have plenty of those responsible ones in my family. I'm worried about the ones who don't lock them and their kids get a hold of them. So those are the ones that I'm fearful of. And I think you and I agree on that. And also thank you for saying no to guns on campus. I wouldn't dream of letting my son go to a school where a university where the students are allowed to have guns, because I know I remember as a college student how people had, you know, students had emotions running high and stress was high and pressure was high. And I can only imagine what kind of recipe for disaster that could be for allowing those guns on campus. So, well,
and to give the other side of it, the people who support it, you know, and I respect how they feel, because they feel like in college campuses, the kids are sitting ducks because you could have an active shooter and really they're sitting ducks without a way to defend themselves. So I understand that argument and I respect it. I do. And how they feel just as strongly, you know, as we do. But it's, you've got to balance the two and say which one has the higher risk of happening.
Sure.
So we will leave that ongoing discussion there. But I do want to ask you one more question, Sheila, which is, as you mentioned, you were involved in the PTA, then you were involved in the city council, then you served 6 years in the state house. You're going to have some time on your hands come January. What's next for you?
Well, you know, I was account coordinator for a fragrance company, and I continue to do that, you know, even when we were out of session. So I'm back doing that again. So it hasn't changed yet. I'm just open to any opportunities that come my way, and I'm in a good place. I'm very happy with my life. So
you're not renouncing politics?
I'm not renouncing it. You know, you always have to leave the door open because you don't know. The Senate race in my district will be open in 2 years. You never know how I'll be feeling in 2 years. Maybe it'll be a good thing to be away from all the craziness down there for a little while. But, you know, I'm just kind of leaving myself open to whatever opportunities come my way.
Well, we will perhaps in 2 years be talking to you again here on State House Blend then. I want to thank Eric Bunch, our citizen guest, the policy director for Bike Walk KC. Thanks, Eric.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brian.
And also Representative Sheila Solon, Republican from Blue Springs.
Super fun. Thanks for having me.
Really glad to have you. And before you go, we always ask our guests to help us end the show with a song of their choice. This is your one big chance.
My big chance,
your walk-off music. What is it?
Well, you know, you think I'd pick something inspirational, but I'm going to pick probably one of the greatest songs to dance to. And I challenge anyone to not dance to this song, My Prerogative, Bobby Brown.
My Prerogative by Bobby Brown. Some very fitting closing music for the representative from Blue Springs, Her Prerogative, to choose that song. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Before we go, we have some big news for the podcast. Beginning next week, we're splitting this show into two separate podcasts, Statehouse Blend Kansas and Statehouse Blend Missouri. Don't worry, it'll be the same great content and the same hosts, but to keep hearing about the people and the issues in the Missouri General Assembly, you will need to search iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Statehouse Blend Missouri. Sam Zeff will continue to cover everything in the Kansas legislature here on this feed, which will be renamed Statehouse Blend Kansas. So, September 1st, look for Statehouse Blend Missouri, and of course, please subscribe. Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. Remember, you can find us anytime at kcur.org/statehouseblend. If you use Twitter, that's a great way to keep up with the show and with me. I'm at PTS Brian. My co-host Sam Zeff is at Sam Zeff. We always try to use the hashtag Statehouse Blend. You can find a shorter version of us on the air on Tuesday mornings as part of Up to Date. That's at 11 a.m. on KCUR 89.3. If you have any other thoughts, write to me at brian@kcur.org. Look for us as Statehouse Blend Missouri soon, and we'll see you next time.